Amen. You can have a seat, and as you're sitting down, grab your Bibles or turn them on and open up to Exodus chapter 1. You heard a portion of what we're going to be looking at this morning read. While you're turning there, let me mention real quick, especially if this is your first week with us or one of your first few weeks, you got a handout on the way in, and on the back of that, there's three things to know. The first thing there is there's what we're calling starting point happening today. So every first Sunday of the month between the 9 a.m. and the 11 a.m. gathering, we're gonna have this thing called starting point at 10:20. So like right after the 9 a.m. gets out, you can head over there to the library. There'll be a sign out front. And this is a good opportunity just to hear more about what it means that we view the church as family and kind of who we are as a church. And the goal really is so that you can get to know who we are better and hang out with us for a while, get any questions answered that you might have, and just understand what it looks like to be a part of the family here should you choose to make Veritas your home church. So we'd love to have you there. That's immediately after this gathering. You can, if you have kids in Veritas Kids, you can leave them there and those folks will watch them until that's done, and it's going to be about 20 or 30 minutes, just kind of depending on questions. So hope to see you there if you are new with us or if this is one of your first few weeks with us. We started 2 weeks ago a series in Exodus. You heard us read a portion of Exodus just before this sermon. We started a series in Exodus that we're going to be in for the majority of the spring and the summer. We've entitled this series Redemption, which just means freedom, the process of being set free, and their story, the people of Israel, is our story. So the first week, we started with an overview, actually, of the book of Genesis, because Exodus opens in the Hebrew with the word and connecting it to everything that happened before. So we just talked about what happened in Genesis, and in Genesis, God made a promise to Abraham that he was going to make him a great nation and bless the world through him. And then last week, we did an overview of Exodus. So we did an overview of what's going on in Exodus, kind of to grasp some major themes of this whole story we saw in Exodus. And Exodus shows us a God who moves to set his people free. This is what happens. God is going to move to set his people free from their slavery in Egypt, and he's going to continue to set them free as they wander through the wilderness. And it's so important for us to understand that the God of the Exodus is the God that we worship today. I think we can unintentionally, because sometimes we're not sure what to do with, well, there's the Old Testament and the New Testament, and it's like there's the old God, and then there's the new God, Jesus, and he seems a lot more chill and relaxed than the old God, and so I like him. It's the same God. It's the same God. The God of the Exodus is the same God that we worship today. So we're going to look now at Exodus chapter 1. Exodus 1, you heard this. I want to read this one more time, a bit of this. Exodus 1, beginning in verse 1, says this. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph, one of his other sons, was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. Now, why start the book this way? We talked about in the first week why start with the word and it's to connect everything that we're about to see in Exodus to everything that's happened in Genesis. But why start with this? Why start with the list of names? I think it'd be easier for us to maybe talk to the author and be like, hey, bro, you need a little bit better of a hook to catch people, and a list of names is going to make people like, oh, this is one of those books that just lists a bunch of names. I'm going to skip through this. Why would he begin this way? Because God is faithful to his promises. This is why the book of Exodus starts this way. This is a major theme throughout the whole Bible. The authors of Scripture, through the inspiration of God the Spirit, are going to do all kinds of things to ingrain in us that God is always faithful to his promises. And this is why he starts the book of Exodus this way. Because in Genesis, God has made a promise to Abraham and to Isaac, his son, and to Jacob to make them a great nation. But the book of Genesis actually ends with, they're not really that great of a nation. There's 70 of them. There's a massive famine that broke out. They had to leave their land and go to Egypt. So the book of Genesis kind of ends with, boy, if this is the definition of what a great nation is, I'm not sure that I buy it. Exodus begins, and the author of Exodus masterfully helps us see God is faithful to his promises, and he sets us up that way because he's going to enter us into a deeper part of the story that's going to make us doubt whether or not God's going to be true to his promises. So he's helping us see that. God promised to make them a nation, and in these first seven verses, he's like, he's done exactly that. All the sons of Jacob came to Israel. They've multiplied. They've grown exceedingly strong to the point where they're filling the land of Egypt, this foreign nation. Now look what happens. Look what happens next in verse 8. We're going to read the rest of the chapter here. Verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt, again, where the people of Israel were filling the land, who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. So the people of Israel didn't start in Egypt in slavery. They're there kind of as guests, and the old Pharaoh who did know Joseph, he's caring for them. He gave them even land in this place. This new king, this new Pharaoh raises up and is like, uh-oh. There are too many of them. Like if one of these foreign nations decides to come and attack us, the Israelites could be like, hey, we're going to go with them and overthrow us. And this is what he does in verse 11. Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They, the people of Israel, built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. The author's doing it again. God's faithful to his promises. They try to oppress them, doesn't work. The more they're oppressed, the more they multiply, just like God has always promised. The more they spread abroad, and the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. Verse 13, so they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. So the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, his solution is let's make them slaves. There's a whole lot of them. Economically, it'll be better. They can work as slaves. We don't have to pay them. And they're just going to build for us these things. It doesn't work, though. Look what happens in verse 15. The people keep multiplying. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of them was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live. So the king of Pharaoh, the people of Israel are multiplying too much, and he comes up with this solution. I'm going to tell the midwives, the people who are helping the Hebrew women give birth, if the baby's born, it's a son, you kill it. This is his solution. Again, the people are multiplying. Pharaoh's like, I got this. I know what to do. Look what happens. Verse 15. We already read that. Verse 18. 17. There it is. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So they're like, nope, we're not doing that. Verse 18, so the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and let the male children live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt with the midwives. God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Verse 22, then Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. Think about this. Things are getting bad. They're in Egypt. They've left Israel because of a famine, and as the generations go on, the king of Egypt says, let's put them in slavery. So they put them in slavery. They continue to multiply because God's always faithful to his promises. They continue to multiply. The king of Egypt says, okay, midwives, when a Hebrew boy is born, kill that boy. The midwives are like, no, we're not doing that. We're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. And then they intentionally deceive Pharaoh. Hey man, like there's not much we can do about these Hebrew ladies. they're kind of Amazon women, and like when they, we don't even get there in time to help them give birth. They just do it without us. God deals kindly with them. Now, a quick side note. This culturally would not have been normal. The author goes to great lengths to celebrate what these women are doing. So I think there's a thing culturally right now where we think the Bible's oppressive towards women and all this. Let me just highlight a quick example. This culturally would not have been normal to highlight something that a woman did. And the author is saying, man, it was these women who took the initiative and said to the king of Egypt, to the Pharaoh, we're not going to do that. And they don't do it. God honors them and God blesses them. But for the people of Israel, things continue to get worse. It's not working, the Pharaoh's plan. So he just says to all the people of Egypt, hey, the midwives aren't able to do this. I want you all to know when a Hebrew male is born, throw it in the Nile. This is just genocide. I mean, he's just trying to stamp out the people of God. Things go from bad to worse, which begs this question for us. What happens when things go wrong? I think the best way for us to understand story, for us to understand narrative like this, is to put ourselves in the story. This is how you grasp the concept of a story that an author is telling, be it history or fiction. This is history, historical narrative. The way to do it is to place yourself in the story. What would you be feeling? You're the people of Israel. God has promised you, I'm going to increase you. I'm going to bless you. You're watching your little babies be killed. Wouldn't you be thinking this sure doesn't feel like blessing? You're doing everything you can to hide the fact that you just had a male and some Egyptian person gives you away and you watch that person throw your baby boy into the Nile. But God's promised he's going to bless you and make you a blessing. How would you feel? Things have gone wrong. The people of Israel would have been feeling like, God, this isn't how things are supposed to be. This isn't how things are supposed to go. We're supposed to be your treasured possession. What's happening here? I think we can resonate with them. The Israelites have these promises. Things have gotten bad, really bad. And what they probably would be thinking is what I certainly would be thinking. And what I'm guessing you would be thinking. What gives? God? Was that just a tease that you promised we were going to be this great nation, that you were going to bless us? Here we are, as if us being enslaved in a foreign nation wasn't enough. Now we're watching our children being killed. During this time, your name was all that you had. And if you're watching your baby boys through whom your name was going to continue on be killed, you know, my name's going to be forgotten to the world. Sure doesn't feel like blessing God. Maybe you can relate with them. What happens when things go wrong in your life? When you get a call from the doctor and you've got cancer, and it's not treatable. What happens then? What happens when you experience the death of a loved one? You get a phone call that just wrecks your entire world. What then? What happens when you experience abuse at the hands of another? You probably feel what the people of Israel would have felt. What gives, God? Why? Why? When you experience a broken relationship, when you have a good friend who just rejects you and this relationship that was so life-giving for you is over, what happens when your career explodes? Like the path that you had mapped out for your life, it's just done because of one accident, one bad decision, one wrong decision, maybe made by somebody other than you. What happens when you end up working for a boss who holds your entire career in their hand? And you watch them just make a mess of your whole life. What then? What happens when things go wrong? When you experience financial troubles and you look at your kids and your wife and you're just thinking, you look at your family and you're thinking, I don't know how we're going to make it. I promise that I'm going to care for you. And I don't know how I'm going to get through this. What happens then? What do we do when things go wrong? Look at what the Israelites do at the end of chapter 2. So skip to the end of chapter 2 in Exodus, verse 23. During those many days, the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, died, and the people of Israel, here's what they do. They groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. To who? Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and he knew. There's a reason that we can so deeply identify with the cry of the people of Israel here. There's a reason that we can hear that and say, that's what my soul is crying right now. Or you can read it and say, boy, that sounds like maybe something I should cry. You're groaning because of something. The reason that we can so deeply relate to what they're doing in the midst of their slavery is because, like the Israelites, we're all enslaved. Like the Israelites, we all either currently are or at one time were enslaved. That's why we can resonate, relate so deeply with them. There's an angst in us that feels like what we're experiencing in some way or another is not what we should be experiencing. When you get that phone call, when you lose that loved one, there's this soul angst that we feel that's right and good. You should feel that. That's like, this isn't how things should be. Maybe it makes us ask, why do bad things happen to good people? Like, why? Why does it seem like evil people, they just thrive and they're fine? This boss that I have that's evil and wicked and has no integrity is thriving and his career is advancing and mine is being destroyed because I'm trying to act with integrity. We look at the world around us and say, why is there so much evil? Why is there so much evil? It doesn't take very long flipping through the news once you get past the stupid celebrity gossip or what's going on politically. It doesn't take very long before you're just confronted with this evil that you're like, what is this? Why is it this way? Maybe for you, resonating with the Israelites is you asking the question, why am I the way that I am? If people in here knew the real me, if they knew the things that I've done, if they knew the things that maybe I haven't done but that I think about all the time, why am I the way that I am? Why am I prone to self-destruct? Why do I blow up every relationship in my life? Why am I so dead set on making myself miserable? We can relate with them, and the reason is, we're going to talk about this all through the book of Exodus, because like the Israelites, we're enslaved. This is what the Bible is going to say. There's a guy called Mike Wilkerson who wrote a book called Redemption. That's just a beautiful book. And he brings our slavery, what we're enslaved to, into these different categories that I've found really helpful. And he categorizes them in three ways. There's abuse, addictions, and what he would call assorted trouble. And I think these are really helpful for us to, I think reading through these, we'll see, yes, that's right. Either I am or I was enslaved, certainly. Abuse is rampant in our culture. We're in the middle of a bit of an awakening to abuse that's happened in our culture, but certainly that abuse is nothing new. The strong have always abused the weak. The strong have always abused the marginalized. And we're just growing in our awareness of it. It's a good thing that we're growing in that awareness, but it's not something new. I know that there are people in this room who have experienced abuse. I mean, the amount, if you just read statistics, the amount of children who are abused before they turn 10 years old, and like 90-some percent of that is by somebody that they know, love, and trust. It's not strangers who are doing these things. It's rampant. Maybe you were abused as an adult. What ends up happening is we become absolutely defined by that abuse. What's happened to us, or if we're the abuser, what's been done by us, try as we may to rid ourselves of it, we end up becoming completely defined by that abuse. And it leads to what I've seen in a lot of people that I've talked with and prayed with and wept with, is it becomes the thing that you feel is the truest part about you. It defines who you are, and then there's guilt and shame. What did I do to deserve this? What did I do to make this happen? Surely there's something that I could have done differently. And so we have this introspection that's like, somehow I did something to deserve this. So there's guilt or there's shame or there's just hatred and anger. And it's easy to feel like you're enslaved by that. Try as you may to say, no, I'm going to move on from this. Maybe I'm going to walk through forgiveness, or I'm never going to forgive. Try as we may to move on from that, we know there's things you can do to numb the pain, but you can't free yourself from that. This feels in a lot of ways like you're enslaved to that. It becomes your master, and no matter what you do, you can't shake those bonds. It's because we're enslaved. Another category that he gives is addictions. So for you, it may not be abuse, but certainly maybe you can resonate with being enslaved to addictions. We hear these addictions. I mean, there's sex, drugs, alcohol. I think those are helpful, but certainly there are more things. Statistics would say 70% of men aged 18 to 34 visit a pornographic site every single month. And there's no, like, that's outside the church. Outside the church, 70% of men visit a pornographic. That's just data. Christians, non-Christians, people who love Jesus, people who don't. 30% of those admitting to a sexual addiction are women. This isn't just a, men, y'all need to get yourself together. Like, you need to fix this about you. 30% of those who admit, I have a sexual addiction, are women. This is not a single gender issue. With drugs, there's a lot of us who end up addicted to drugs, and we do everything we can to say, no, no, I'm not, but that's the only way that you can numb the pain that you feel inside. Those could be illicit drugs. I think a new problem that we're becoming more and more aware of is there's painkillers. If you're in the let me just say this, if you're in the military, you know what can happen is we throw drugs at a problem. I certainly can resonate with that. After an injury, there was a period of time where I was severely addicted to painkillers and medicine to try to help me sleep, and it was me trying to numb something in my life. There wasn't actually pain there anymore. There was just the pain of me feeling like I wasn't enough because my career was gone. We got to talk about this in the church. You can't ignore it. You can't just ignore your slavery and hope that someday it's going to be gone. It could be alcohol, but the reality is this is anything. Like, we have those. Oh, okay, sex, drugs, alcohol, those are the bad ones, but this could be anything. For some people, it's food. For some people, it's sugar. For some, I mean, whatever it is, it's that thing that you're like, I can't, without this, I can't make it. For some of you, it's your phone. The thought of you putting your phone down and not being connected is terrifying to you. And we kind of joke about it. Well, that's not a serious one. But in the same way, you're mastered by it, completely mastered by it. The problem is, a lot of the ways that we deal with addiction, we end up substituting a certain slavery for just a new slavery. Here's what I mean by that. The thing that you're enslaved to becomes the thing that defines you. Alcoholics Anonymous. Hey, my name's Jim. I'm an alcoholic. What are we communicating to people? That your addiction, I mean, this thing in your life is the deepest and the truest part of you? How depressing is that? Then all of a sudden, the new thing you're enslaved to is sobriety rather than alcohol. And it may look a little bit better, and you may not do harm to yourself or to other people, but you've got a new master, and that master is sobriety. And my question is, what happens when you go back to the bottle? What happens when you go back to painkillers? What happens when you're completely defined by now the things that you don't do that you used to do? That's not true freedom. Addiction is another way that we're enslaved. The third thing that he talks about is assorted trouble. And what he means by this is this is any sin or suffering that you may experience. So there are some things that they may not be addictions, but this is just any sin or suffering that you may experience. This is you being sinned against. Maybe you wouldn't categorize it as physical abuse or emotional abuse, but you've been sinned against. You have broken relationships, people who have wronged you. And the reality is, for a lot of us, that becomes the thing that defines us, that masters us, feeling the bitterness and the rage and the anxiety towards it. For you, maybe you're a slave to physical illness. There's something physically going on with you, and it just feels like that's the truest part of who you are. Like, you just can't picture yourself without that thing defining you. It's easy to feel enslaved to it. This could be a loss of job or financial security. This could be a pattern of sin. Maybe you wouldn't classify it as an addiction, but there's just this sin that no matter what you do, it seems like you keep getting tripped up by it. You keep returning to it. So maybe you wouldn't say, well, I'm not addicted to it, but I feel like I just keep returning to it over and over and over again. For you, this could be anxiety. This could be this crushing fear that you feel like things are just about to fall apart in your life. Everything's going to go wrong. You're mastered by that feeling. That's what it means to be enslaved. You're mastered by it. This could be an eating disorder. This could be for you a body image thing where you're like, that expresses itself as an eating disorder. Now all of a sudden that becomes the thing that's the truest part of who you are, and you're mastered by it. It could be depression. Be like, man, I come in here and I act like everything's okay, but it's not okay. Maybe it's adultery or divorce, this thing that you did years ago that's still impacting our relationship right now. We could go on and on and on. Or I would add another category. I think you can be enslaved to yourself. Because the way that culture deals with all those problems, addiction, abuse that's happened to you, assorted troubles, is by trying desperately to convince yourself that you're good enough, that you're okay, that it's true. The problem with you is what other people have done. And if you just had our culture says that our self-esteem is our problem. That's why we're addicted to all these other things. And if we just felt good enough about ourselves, we wouldn't run to these things. Well, that's not true. When we think, like, why talk about all this change? You just need to be fine with who you are. And the problem is that doesn't deal with the fact that you may be able to fake it for a while, but you're never fine with who you are. You wake up and look in the mirror and you feel just as much defined and enslaved to the thing that you're trying to convince yourself you're better than, you're just good enough. We end up enslaved to ourselves. You may not be enslaved by what other people think of you, but you sure are enslaved by what you think of you. Your opinion of yourself becomes the thing that defines your entire reality. It's easy to feel like that defines who you are. It becomes your master, and there's nothing you can do to break free of it. You see how much we're like the Israelites? Like the Israelites, we're enslaved. We have things that are functioning as our masters. And like the Israelites, there's nothing we can do about it. The Israelites cry out to God. You want to know what doesn't happen with the Israelites? They don't enter into some 10-step, 12-step program. And I'm not, those things can be helpful. Please don't hear me say, but I just don't think they're full. Because it's a way that we just say, I can get myself out of this. And at best, what we often do is exchange slavery to one thing for slavery to another thing. And so maybe you don't look at porn as much anymore. But you spend the entire night playing video games so that you won't look at porn. You're no more engaged with your family. You're no more engaged with what's going on around you. You're just serving a new master now. Like the Israelites, there's nothing we can do about it. Like the Israelites, we need real redemption, real freedom. Not the freedom that culture says is going to satisfy, because we both know at the end of the day, it does not satisfy. We need real freedom like the Israelites did. We need to cry out to God. We need to cry out to God. This is what the Israelites do, and it says God remembered. God's about to act on his promises. Let me show you a really encouraging part of this story that I think is easy to miss. Look what happens at the beginning of Acts 2, or Exodus 2. I'm going to read the first 10 verses here. Now a man from the house of Levi went and took a wife, as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months because, again, Pharaoh the king is killing all the babies. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the river bank. And his sister, this child's sister, stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river. While her young women walked beside the river, she saw the basket with his child in it among the reeds, sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. This is a Hebrew child. She took pity on him, Pharaoh's daughter did, and said, "This is one of the Hebrew's children." Then his sister, this baby's sister who's watching this happen, his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call for you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" Verse 8, and Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother, who had trusted God and put this baby into a river. She goes and calls the mother, and Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, because she said, "I drew him out of the water." So here we're introduced to this person, Moses. Now what happens in the rest of chapter 2 is Moses is raised in the court of Pharaoh. He's raised in the household of Pharaoh, very much treated like a child of Pharaoh. He's raised as an Egyptian. And as he's an Egyptian, there becomes this point where he goes out and he sees the people of Israel enslaved and he feels empathy towards them. His heart goes out to them. He sees an Egyptian beating an Israelite. He takes things into his own hands and he kills this Egyptian. We're going to see from Moses that Moses has a problem with impulsivity and rage, and it gets him into a lot of trouble. He's not quite the hero that, again, we would think. He sees this, and then he's gone. He runs. He runs out of fear to Pharaoh. There's just this little bit of the story thrown in there. But do you notice the timing? We're introduced to this person named Moses, who's going to be a major character in Exodus. God is going to, through him, use him in a mighty way in the deliverance of God's people. But notice the timing. God begins to raise Moses up before the people of Israel cry out for deliverance. In their slavery, before they ever cry out for God to free them, God's working. God's moving. God's not forgotten his people. He's raising up Moses. Church, I need to be encouraged with that. Yes, like the people of Israel, I am, you are, we are enslaved. There's nothing that we can do about it. We need redemption, and so we ought to cry out to God. And let me encourage you, God's working before you cry out to him. This is the pattern throughout the whole Bible. Yes, you have a responsibility to cry out, but God's working behind the scenes even before that. Before they cry out for deliverance, God is raising up a deliverer for the people. We're not done with Moses. Moses is born before the people realize, before the people cry out to God. Here's the good news, church. Before you even realize that you're enslaved, that you need redemption, God's working. God's working to bring you deliverance. You need a better story. I need a better story. We need a better story than the one we're told to live out by culture around us. And Exodus is going to tell a better story. And it's not just going to tell you a better story. It's going to invite you into that story and say, this story can be your story. This story can be your story. It's going to show us what true freedom looks like, and it's going to show us that true freedom is actually possible. Redemption is actually possible, and Exodus is going to point us forward to Jesus as our redemption. That's the truth of the Bible. Jesus is your redemption. Jesus is going to bring true and lasting freedom that squashes the fake freedom that we try to find all the time. Jesus is your redemption, and maybe this is the first time that you're hearing that. And there's something in your heart that leaps at that, that just says, could that be true? Could it be true? Could it be true that through this God-man, Jesus Christ, true freedom is possible? Like, yeah, I get it. You didn't have to tell me. I feel enslaved every day. Are you telling me that true freedom is actually possible? Yes. Hang with us. We're going to talk about it every single week as we go through the book of Exodus, as we see God work with an outstretched arm to deliver his people. We're going to see how he works to deliver us. before we even know to cry out to him. Maybe you're in here and you agree with this in theory. You're like, yeah, I've heard that. Jesus is my redemption. But it doesn't really do anything for you. I think the reason is we don't know how. So maybe you hear that and you're like, that sounds good. Jesus is my redemption. Jesus brings freedom. I don't feel very free. Like, I don't feel that way. We're going to see that in the people of Israel. Them being set free from their slavery in Egypt is not the end of their slavery. What happens when you don't feel it? Or maybe you say, like, yeah, I hear that all the time. That's church language. Jesus is my redemption. How does that happen? What does it look like? Mike Wilkerson gives this illustration of our problem with understanding Jesus as the one who comes to bring us freedom, who comes to bring us redemption, is we typically only focus on the end of the story. We focus on, okay, Jesus hanging on the cross, bearing my sin. Okay, great. But when we miss all the rest of the story just isn't as powerful for us. And he uses this illustration. Like, if you've never seen The Return of the King in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy, like, if you've never seen that, and all that happened was you saw this movie that they made a movie, and the only scene in the entire movie, all three movies, the only scene that you see is when the hobbits make it up the mountain and they throw the ring into the fire. And somebody's like, this is the point. This is the central point in all the books. This is how the land is freed. This is how people are freed. You're like, that's cool, but those guys look weird, and I don't quite. Like, if you don't understand the journey that they've been on and all that's happened and why there's slavery in the land to begin with, if you don't understand what's happened before this, you may be like, well, that's pretty cool, but I don't understand how. What does a little ring have to, seriously, the ring? This is what we're all scared of here? This little ring? This movie's lame, right? We got to understand the story. This is what Exodus is going to do for us. Exodus is going to help us understand the backstory. Exodus is going to help us understand how their story really is our story. Jesus comes to bring freedom, and he brings freedom through taking your slavery on himself, taking the things that you're enslaved to on himself, paying the penalty for them. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, he, God, made the one who did not know sin to be sin for us so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. What Paul says is God made his son, Jesus Christ, who knew no sin. Like, he never sinned. He never was enslaved to anything. He made him to be sin and poured out the penalty for that sin on Jesus, so that in Jesus, by faith in him, we might become the righteousness of God. We might be freed from the things we're enslaved to and made children of God, given a truer identity than the ones that we typically chase. We've been delivered from the penalty of sin. Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death, but the free gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus. We've been freed from the penalty of sin. We've been freed from the presence of sin. Where sin used to reign in our lives, it no longer reigns. Now, it will remain, and we'll talk about that. A lot of us feeling enslaved is because we just don't know as Christians what to do with the fact that there's sin that remains. Doesn't reign anymore. The power of sin has been broken in your life. And that's what we're going to talk about with this whole, the grace that saved us also changes us. We've been delivered from the penalty of sin, the power of sin, and we will be delivered from the presence of sin. One day, it won't even remain anymore. It's going to be gone. It's going to be obliterated in the entire world. Jesus is your redemption. We're going to continue to talk about what that looks like. We're going to just saturate ourselves in the beauty of what it means that Jesus is our redemption. Won't you turn to him, maybe for the first time today, or turn to him again today? The band's going to come up now, and I want to lead us through response. For some of you in here, your response today is to, for the first time, cry out to Jesus as your deliverer. If you're feeling this, like, could it be true? Could it be true that Jesus can bring real redemption, real freedom in my life? Maybe for you, it's for the first time crying out in faith, Jesus, save. Like, would you do that? Or maybe it's you being honest about your doubt. Jesus, I sure doubt that you can do this. I sure would love to hear how you do. Maybe that's what you do. If you're a follower of Jesus, we're going to celebrate communion. I'm going to pray, and then right away, we're going to all together come and receive communion. At communion, we're going to remember what Jesus did to really set us free. One of the reasons that we do communion every single week is because I need to be reminded every single week that I truly am free. Because like the Israelites, we will see, I have a tendency to run back to what I was enslaved to and forget that I have been set free. And communion is God's gracious reminder of the lengths that Jesus went to purchase our freedom. His body was crushed. So we take a piece of bread, we dip it in the juice, and remember his blood was poured out. And church, God intends to build your faith through this simple meal this morning. Because you're going to walk in here and you're going to feel like, I still feel enslaved. I love Jesus. I believe that he set me free, but I don't feel free. God's going to, through this meal, say, you're free. You're free. This is the lengths I went to. My body was crushed. My blood was shed. That's why we do it every single week. If you're not a follower of Jesus, while you watch those who are followers of Jesus come and be reminded of the fact that we've been set free, there's going to be some prayers that are going to scroll on the screen up here, and we found these to be helpful ways to respond to what's going on, be it doubt or belief for the first time, be it I'm not so sure, to boy, I think this is true and I want to respond to it. We found those to be helpful. After we take communion, we're going to sing. We're going to sing of our hope in Jesus Christ. We're going to sing of the fact that we can't do it. And then during that first song, buckets are going to pass, and this is us giving to see this message of freedom, this message of redemption continue to be advanced in this city, in this nation, and across the world. If you are a guest with us or you're not a follower of Jesus, please don't feel obliged to give, obligated to give at all. Maybe you just drop this connect card in there for the first time. We'd love to help you get connected, or if you've got a prayer request, you can drop that in those buckets. I'm going to pray, and then again, just come and receive communion if you're a follower of Jesus. Jesus, I thank you for what you did to purchase our freedom. I thank you that though, like the Israelites, we're enslaved, you offer true freedom. Would you teach us by your Spirit what that means? For those of us who are followers of you, Jesus, I pray that you would help us to see the ways that we continue to turn our eyes back towards the things you've set us free from, that you continue to set us free, Jesus. Thank you for what you've done. Thank you for this meal to remember that. We love you. It's in your name. It's through you and because of you that we pray.